How are we? Are we all right? Holding up? Some weeks we get to choose what we want to talk about in our Dharma talks, and other weeks the Dharma talks choose us. And this is one of those weeks. We had this really hot week. We continue to have a really hot week. As I understand, we're going to have another hot week. So in the middle of all of that heat, one of my favorite koans just kept coming up and coming up. And it's a famous one. It's one that I think probably a lot of you know. It involves Dongshan Liangzhu. He was a 9th century Chinese Zen master monk. And the koan on one level is about heat. So that's why that one came up for me this week. It's case 43 from the Blue Cliff Record. So a monk asked Dongshan, "When cold and heat come, how can we avoid them?" And Dongshan said, "Why don't you go where there is no cold, no heat?" I'm thinking North Carolina. Somewhere there's got to be no cold, no heat. Why don't you go where there's no cold, no heat? The monk asked, "What is this place where there's no cold or no heat?" And in Dogen's end to that koan, Dogen has Dongshan say, "When it is cold, be completely cold. When it is hot, be completely hot." Or another translation of that is, "When it's cold, be a cold Buddha. When it's hot, be a hot Buddha." The actual original had Dongshan saying, "When it's cold, the cold kills you, and when it's hot, the hot kills you." By that, he didn't literally mean kills you. It's like in the saying, if you should meet Buddha in the road, kill him. They're not saying to actually kill Buddha. They're saying to drop that idea of Buddha that you have. If you meet Buddha in the road, it's probably not Shakyamuni Buddha. So drop that idea. So that's what I think the "when it's cold, the cold kills you" means. So I like to use Dogen's translation better. When it's cold, be completely cold, or be a cold Buddha. When it's hot, be a hot Buddha. So the monk that went to Dongshan with this question, he's looking for some relief. He's looking for some respite. Can I speak louder? I think so. I wonder about that. I'm looking at the air conditioner. Tonin last year was here, and she said, "We have a terrible decision to make." Yes, I will try to speak louder. How's that? Is that better? Or should we? What do you think? Let's give it a try. Let's see how we do without it. Does it go down or just... All right, we've got the fans on high. We'll see how we do. All right, so the monk is looking for some relief. He's looking for some respite. And of course, on one level, what he's actually asking about is the heat. So let me talk about that first. We had these hot days this week. And on Friday, I was invited to sit with some friends in a garden in the morning to do sitting meditation for half an hour in this beautiful garden near downtown Minneapolis at 7 a.m. And it was wonderful. We're in this beautiful, beautiful garden, and we sit down in kind of a semicircle, and... About a minute after the bell rang, it's going to do that. A minute after the fan started squeaking, about a minute after the bell rang, I realized that I had made a strategic error. I was facing north, and so the hot sun, even at 7 in the morning, the sun was hot, and it was just beating right on the side of my face. And I thought, well, we're not sitting in the zendo. Can I just, like, move my chair? And then good girl mode kicked in, and I said, no, you can't move your chair. And then I thought about Dongshan saying, go where there's no cold and no heat. And I thought, really, what's important here? You know? Is it that hot sun on the side of my face? Or is it the fact that I'm sitting in this beautiful garden, surrounded by friends, and I not only hear the wind in the trees, but the other thing that I could hear was the traffic as people were driving to work. And there was something about that traffic that I could feel that I was right in the middle of it all. You know, all the fellow human beings going off to work, starting their day, and there's this wonderful feeling of connectedness with all those people. So what's more important, the heat here or the beautiful setting? So I decided to let go of that lovely feeling of connectedness too and just sit there. I took a couple of minutes of sitting in lovely connectedness, I'll admit that. But just sit there. And you know, when you just sit there with that hot sun on the side of your face, what you find out is that it's really okay. It's just hot sun on the side of your face. Dogen said, when it's hot, you know, be completely hot. So what does that feel like, actually? You know, the being hot really isn't the, I can't believe I sat down and I'm facing north, and Lee must have sat here before because he had the good sense to face west. And, you know, that's not actually the hot. That's not actually the hot, you know. Could you actually just be interested in what it feels like on your face? What does it feel like on your face? What does it feel like on your skin? What's it feel like on your shoulders, you know? Where does the physical sensation of heat leave off and the mental chatter about the heat, which is the suffering, right? Where does that begin? You know, can you find that place in between the two of them? And then you let go of that too. So this practice that we have here, it's about functioning right in the middle of cold and heat. Not avoiding them, not avoiding our life, not avoiding the conditions in our life that right at this moment we might not think are ideal. You know, we don't choose hot or cold weather. We do choose to live in Minnesota, but we don't choose the weather, literal weather or metaphorical weather that blows through our lives. The thing that we can choose to do, though, is not turn it into suffering. We can make that choice. So there's that. But the monk, he's also asking, where can I find that upright place when my temper is hot, when it's my temper that's hot? Where can I find that upright place when my heart is cold? And that's a little harder, I think. Has this ever happened to you? Somebody says something to you, and it's relatively innocent, maybe even friendly, and then suddenly, right out of nowhere, boom! You know, you go into this huge explosion of anger. Just something pressed that button, and there it is, all of a sudden. It's that white hot temper arising. Does anybody here know that feeling besides me? Okay, good. We know what we're talking about. So our buttons get pushed. You know, I was thinking, it's as if somebody pushed what they thought was a doorbell, but what I heard it as was the torpedo release button on a submarine. You know, they're innocently pressing this, expecting ding dong, and what they get is this torpedo coming back at them. And it's in launch mode, you know, and it's in a blink. We respond I almost want to say reflexively, but we respond that quickly and explosively. But in between when the doorbell got rung and the torpedo got launched, there's this tiny, tiny little synapse of time. Somewhere recently I read someone called that moment of time in between, they called it the sacred pause. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. I can work with that. It's a sacred pause. And if you can catch that sacred pause, if you can catch that little blink of an eye, you can see what's happening inside you. You can see that anger start to arise and respond more appropriately, maybe more kindly. Maybe more kindly. And that is one of the fruits of meditation, actually. We see these, you know, we sit here and we see these thoughts endlessly, you know, over years. We sit here, we see these thoughts coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. And over time, we can begin to spot them right at the moment that they arise. Right at the moment some emotion arises out of those thoughts that are coming and going. And that's mindfulness. It's mindfulness standing watch at the door. That's what mindfulness is, when you're able to see that in the middle of just letting go of your thoughts. So that's in that tiny little synapse before the afflictive emotion arises. And whether or not the explosion occurs, you know, it might happen anyway. You might not be able to catch it. You might not be able to catch it. But whether or not it happens, in the middle, right in the middle of the anger of the moment, or maybe not until you're feeling the remorse and the mortification 10 minutes later, but somewhere in there, you can see that, oh, this is just the human condition. You know, here I am, here we go. And that's mindfulness, watching at the door, saying, this is it, this is what we do. And I just showed you where it started. And now all you need to do is pay attention and catch it, maybe. So, mindfulness is one of the fruits of meditation, and one of the fruits of mindfulness, I think, is compassion. Compassion for this other person who is not really a thoughtless clod. All they've done is push the button. And compassion for ourselves, which is the hard part. Compassion for ourselves. And a little bit of open-heartedness about that human condition, understanding that maybe the next time I see someone else respond that way, I will remember that I responded that way at one point. So that's, I think, that's the point, that's where there's no heat and no cold. You know, in that upright moment, when you have seen the anger arise, but you haven't acted on it yet. You decide not to act on it. And our meditation practice gives us lots of opportunities to watch our thoughts come and go. And over time, we can see them come, we can see them go. We see that happen through our practice of sitting meditation out of Zazen. And out of that, wisdom and compassion arise. You know, they arise just like this. You know, they end up in gassho, with our hands in gassho like that. Here's wisdom, and here's compassion. And there's no gap in between the two of them. You know, when we're in that upright moment, there's no sort of leaning in or craving, you know, and there's sort of no leaning away, there's no aversion. We're just in that upright moment. And when we do slip, on the times when we do slip, you know, we just renew our intention to keep that mindfulness at the door. We make amends We forgive the self and the other. And we remember that we're all just beings that are shivering in the cold every day and sweating in the hot every day. And then we come back endlessly, endlessly. Just like in Zazen, Buddhas sitting like Buddhas. We come back and back and back and try it again. There's a story about Dongshan that I really like. Dongshan being the Zen master in that koan. So the story goes that while he was performing a memorial service for his teacher, Yunyan Tangsheng, Dongshan was asked by a monk why he honored Yunyan, who was relatively unknown. Dongshan had studied with a lot of great masters, but he especially revered Yunyan. And Dongshan answered that it was only because Yunyan had never directly explained anything to him. That's why he liked him. And I'm acutely aware of that, particularly when it's Dharma Talk Week, that we can't really explain Zen. We can't really do it. All we can do is welcome people who want to join us in this practice, you know, welcome people, and help each other stay upright when we start to wobble. That's the gift of Sangha. You know, we help each other when we start to wobble. We help each other when we push each other's buttons and see ourselves start to wobble. So when Dongshan was leaving Yunyan, he asked how to describe Yunyan's reality. He asked Yunyan, when I'm talking about you to other people, how do I describe your reality? Can you imagine somebody asking you that question? How would I describe your reality? Yunyan had an answer. Yunyan said, just this is it. Just this. And then there was a long pause. And then he said, you are in charge of the great matter. You must be thoroughgoing. You are in charge of the great matter. You must be thoroughgoing. Thoroughgoing Zen. That reminded me of something. I think I know someone who's got a Dharma name like that. Donna? Tim's Dharma name is Zentetsu. It means thoroughgoing Zen. So, we must all be thoroughgoing Zen. When we can. So I want to talk a little bit about three women that I have lived in this country recently who I think are thoroughgoing Zen practitioners. And I never met any of them, but I want to talk about them today. This week I was over at Tomoe-san's house, and there was a card on her altar saying that Catherine Thanos died on June 27th. And I'd never met her, but I had heard about her from my Buddhist friends and people that I knew out in California on the West Coast. And so when I saw that altar sign, even though I didn't know her personally, I just had this feeling in my chest, this heavy, kind of dark, sad feeling right here. That's where I feel it, right here. You know what I mean? Do you feel that somewhere? It may not be here, but that's how I feel it. This heavy, kind of dark feeling right there, kind of sad. And it stayed there. I was over there to sew, and it stayed there the whole time we were sewing. Catherine Zanis was the founder of Monterey Zen Center, and she was the first abbot of Santa Cruz Zen Center. She was ordained when she was about 50. I always like to hear those stories because I was too, and it gives me hope, you know, that someday I can be as thoroughgoing a Zen person as Catherine Thanos. Everyone says that Catherine was. So she was ordained when she was about 50. And 13 years later, she received Dharma transmission, or permission to teach independently, from Reb Anderson, who some of you know. And she was 87 when she died last week. So she had a good long life. Tomoinu, I asked Tomoi to tell me something about her. And Tomoi got this big smile on her face, and she said, oh, she was Suzuki Roshi's Jisha, his attendant, during a couple of the early practice periods. And she said, and she was like this. Oh. And that was very high praise from Tomoi. And when she said it, it wasn't like tin soldier. Oh. It was with a big smile, you know. So, and I talked to Susan Nelson on the phone this week, and she said that she had met Catherine when she came here, and she said she had this brightness about her. And Tim also knew her back in the San Francisco Zen Center days, and he had wonderful memories of her also. So that's Catherine Thanis, who died this week. And there were two other women who died within the last year, who also I had that same feeling about, even though I had never met them, but I had also associated them with that thoroughgoing Zen, but also that just this is it, just this. And one of them was named was Della Gertz. She was 99 and a half years old when she died in February, and she was one of the very early people at San Francisco Zen Center when it was founded. Before, actually, it was even San Francisco Zen Center. And I'd read things about her and heard things about her over the years. I don't know where. And one crooked cucumber, but. You know, you hear things about those days in San Francisco Zen Center, and one of the things that I'd always been interested in was that you always hear that there were all these sort of young hippies and beatniks and things, and then there were these three older ladies, three middle-aged ladies, and their names were Della and Betty and
Jean.
Thank you. Della, Betty, and Jean. And they had regular jobs, and they met Suzuki somewhere, and they would come and sit early in the morning, and then Della would go. She was a school teacher, so she'd go teach school all day. She taught second and third grade a lot, and I think she taught kindergarten also. So she'd go teach school, and then she'd come back over and just do whatever needed doing. You know, she'd do little errands for Suzuki, or she'd give him a ride somewhere, and so that's what she did. And in Crooked Cucumber, in his biography, there's a story about Suzuki going to Della's house and meeting her husband. And her husband had advanced Alzheimer's disease. And he was very impressed with the way that Della was able to give really devoted care to him while she was doing all these other things, too. And shortly after that, somebody asked Suzuki whether, he was asked, are there any real bodhisattvas alive today? You know, or are these just mythical beings? Are there any real bodhisattvas alive in the world right now? And he said, yes, Della. It's high praise. So that's Della. And the third one died last October. And she was 87 years old also, and her name was Elsie Mitchell. And I'd heard about her for years. She was one of the founders of Cambridge Zen Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It started in her living room. She and her husband opened up their living room to be Cambridge Zen Center. And that was one of the first Zen centers on the East Coast. And she just had this tireless devotion to Zen. Tireless devotion to Zen. And also, from what I could tell, a real talent for making friends. She knew everybody. So she and her husband first went to Japan, I think it was in 1959. And on one of their early trips, they wanted to make a recording at Eheiji Monastery, which is the big Soto Zen training monastery, the main Soto Zen training monastery. They wanted to make a recording of the monks chanting and the sounds of the bells and the gongs and the ceremonies and, you know, the breakfast service. They wanted to make a recording of all the sounds of Eheiji. And they heard that a lot of the buildings didn't have electricity. So they lugged along this big recording machine that had big giant batteries And every 5 minutes you had to wind it up somehow. I don't really know how that works. But so they lugged all this stuff to Aheiji and made these recordings. And then later on, Folkways Records bought the recordings. You know about Folkways Records? They recorded the old blues singers down in the South and things. And so you could actually buy an album back then of the monks chanting at Aheiji. And then later, the Smithsonian bought the Folkways catalog. And so now you can go online on the Smithsonian Folkways site and you can hear little snippets of the monks chanting at Aheiji and the big bong, the big bells and things. And you can also purchase CDs of it, or deep CDs of it, I guess. So when they were there for that trip, their interpreter and their helper was a young man in civilian clothes who turned out to be Dainin Katagiri, who was the founder later of this place. And he had already been a monk there. He had spent his time as a monk at Aheiji a number of years before. And I think, from what I can figure out, this must have been during the time when he was in graduate school at the university. And somehow he was at Aheiji when they got there. So she said that his English wasn't so good. So as an interpreter, he was maybe not so helpful, but in every other way, he was extremely helpful, and they managed to make themselves understood to each other, and they became lifelong friends. And she told the story of him being out on the roof of Aheiji with a microphone that had a big heavy 24-foot cable to it. And if you've seen pictures of Aheiji, the roofs are those old tile roofs, and they're like this, you know. So he climbed out on the roofs to put the microphone just so that they could make these recordings. So I would like to see a picture of that. So that's Elsie Mitchell. And with each one of them, there's something about these relatively unheralded, but very thoroughgoing women Zen practitioners in this country that just really touches my heart. And each time I heard that one of them had died, I had that, You know, twice a month here on Saturday mornings, we do a formal service. And in that service is included a chant that says, "To all great women practitioners whose names have been left unsung." And we also chant the names of a number of great women Buddhists in history. You know, some of them are from India, and some are from China, some are from Japan, some of them are even mythological. And it's a wonderful chant. But my personal chant list of women includes the Della's and the Elsie's and the Catherine's. And last year it was Joko Beck died. Some of them are well known, some of them are not so well known, some of them are lay, some of them are ordained, but they're on my personal list. So aside from there being thoroughgoing Zen practitioners, mostly I just wanted to say their names in the Zendo and tell their stories in the Zendo this morning. Acknowledge them in the Zendo, you know, in the same way that we do on Saturday morning. So, you know, so say, Elsie Mitchell, Dai Yosho, Della Gertz, Dai Yosho, Catherine Thanis, Dai Yosho. Dai Yosho means great teacher, great teacher. I think I'm going to stop there. Anybody else have something they would like to add or ask about? Yeah, Kate.
You know, hearing you talk about that, you know, hearing those names, feeling that heaviness. Mm-hmm. When I heard about Nora Ephron dying, I had kind of a similar feeling. And you know, the thing about Nora Ephron is she did exactly what she wanted, and she was exactly who she was. And when she wrote her book about aging, she was candid about it. And when she wrote her book about her divorce, and she wrote it and turned it into a movie, there were no punches pulled either, like, you know, in any way. It wasn't, there was nothing about going after anybody. It was just, this is how it is. And they played a little snippet of her saying, you know, I don't know why men always compare making movies to going off to war. If there's a caterer, it's not like going to war.
I like
and
that.
And so I feel kind of, you know, she's a different kind of thing, but she is definitely a woman who was exactly who she was.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt that about her too. Nora Ephron Diosho. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? This morning? I heard a wonderful story about D.T. Suzuki. He was a great translator of Zen texts, mostly Rinzai. I think he was more Rinzai texts in the first half of the 20th century. He lived from 1870 to 1966. So at one point he came to UCLA and to give a talk, and he went into this big auditorium full of students and faculty and staff of UCLA, and very expectantly waiting to hear from him. And he said, he walked up to the microphone and he said, "Zen Buddhism, very hard to understand. Thank you." He turned around and he walked out. And I thought, I like that guy. I like that guy. Of course, the crowd went, you know. There was an uproar. But the person who was reporting it, the person who was telling this story, said, didn't remember anything else about what he said, but just remembered how wonderful that was. There was a point on Wednesday afternoon where I seriously considered trying that. But it's like, who was it with the one-fingered Zen? You know, when the Zen
Gute.
Gute's one-fingered Zen. He would teach, this is one-fingered Zen, and when he did it, it was one thing. When his students would try to do it after him, it didn't work. So, very hard to
understand.
Open-hearted.
Which struck me, because in Chinese, there is no single character for happy, but two, open-hearted.
Really?
Yeah. And I hadn't really thought about it before, but it makes me realize maybe that our use of the word happy, as we understand it in Western terms, is inadequate. It doesn't really describe what maybe in a Middle Eastern philosophical term that people understand by happiness as simply being open-hearted and receptive.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. Did you hear that back there? He said that that I'd use the term open-hearted, and that the Chinese character for happy, right, was two characters. One meant open, and the other one meant hearted. And so there's a different way of looking at the word, at what we think of as happy, when you think of it as open-hearted. Oh, I love that. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
We were talking about the feature that can specifically explain things or something.
Yeah.
I recall the story from my youth. I guess at this point, I was studying with the Tibetan teacher in Boulder, Colorado, from Rinpoche. And I remember his son had a school assignment. It was in the fifth or sixth grade, I think, as I recall. And he said the teacher asked them all to write a short paper, and they had to speak to the class and tell them what religion their family practiced. So he asked his father, he said, so what should I say to Papa Buddhism? And his father was the brother who sat there at the breakfast table and finally his wife and him. After about a half hour, she said, oh, I'm crying out loud. You've been sitting here for a half hour and you can't think of a simple way to describe Buddhism to your son. And he says, honey, this is really difficult.
It's really difficult. I want to find how much I really appreciate what when you were talking about the hot, the cold, and that place where people push your buttons, and how to go to that place where you deal with that. Because the thing I've been trying to practice myself is remembering how many times people may have taken my attention the wrong way, and it was really just a mistake, or I explained myself awkwardly, and to try and remember, like, well, maybe that person really didn't. To help me what I think they're not saying. Maybe they just make a mistake or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like the way that you put it with going to that sacred pause.
Yeah.
That was really helpful and I really appreciate the piece of.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know where I read the idea of the sacred pause and how helpful that is. And I don't know where I read that. I read it somewhere recently. I'm really grateful to whoever said it, you know. The other wonderful thing, you know, when we inadvertently or vertently maybe press somebody else's button, and when we inadvertently do it and they explode, it's very helpful to have had that practice of watching ourselves do it and forgiving self and other so that we can not respond to that explosion in that same way, or even if we do have a hard reaction to it, that we can just at least remind ourselves, oh, I've done that too. That's a human condition, isn't it?